Okay, tonight I want to pick up in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 3 of the book of Isaiah. And just keep this in mind when we're going through this book. This prophet, to me, is one of the most amazing prophets in the Bible. He really is. He's a major prophet. He's got the longest prophetic book in the Bible. And man, he jumps from predicting things that are going to happen in the very near future, and then he just jumps all the way into, you know, the end of the world. He tells about the second coming of Christ. He tells about the Christ millennial reign. I mean, this is just an amazing prophet, and he's the one that told all about Christ being a virgin born, that he, about his death and his burial, his resurrection. I mean, this guy is just absolutely incredible how God used this man. But anyway, I'd like to get into reading this chapter 3. And here's the thing, when we get into chapter 3, Isaiah is prophesying around 740 years before Christ, and he's predicting now what's going to happen to the southern tribe of Israel, which is Judah and Jerusalem. And remember, during his time, it was around that time that the northern tribes were being overrun by the Assyrians because of all their wickedness, and then they went into captivity about 100 years before the southern tribe. So now when Isaiah is making these prophecies, and especially in his chapter 3, and I mean, he's predicting what's going to happen now to the southern tribes because of their wickedness, because of their unfaithfulness to God. But I'm telling you right now, reading him or reading any of these prophets or even any of the historical books, they're not boring, bland, dry history. A lot of people, I think, just overlook these books thinking that there's no relevance there to it. They're just a lot of useless information. I'm telling you, every time you read these prophets, I can see, it just jumps out at me, I can see so clearly an application to where we're at today. So we begin with verse 1 of chapter 3. It says, "For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan, the skillful enchanter, and I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them, and the people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor. The youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable." You know, before we go any further, these first five verses, I mean, he's talking about what's going to happen to Jerusalem because of their forsaking God, because of their idolatry, because even though they lay claim to believe in a God of heaven, they have just completely distorted and perverted the one true worship of the true God. I see this happening in this country. I mean, people lay claim to believe in God, as Paul predicted would happen in the last days, that people would hold to a form of godliness. They would belong to a denomination, or more and more people would claim to be quote-unquote spiritual. But they would worship God in their own way, just the way people are doing today. And look what he's saying about these people, what's going to happen to them. Because he said this in verse 1 of chapter 3 of Isaiah. It says, "For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water." So in other words, as a judgment against these people, they were going to be under siege and they were going to experience tremendous, you know, shortages, right? Well, you can make this application to this country, I think, very well, because look what's happening to our economy. Look what's happening to people financially. I mean, people are just going bankrupt. They're losing their homes. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their pensions, their 401ks. I mean, this is a judgment from Almighty God. It's one way that God's trying to get people's attention and trying to get people back to a proper relationship with Him. But, you know, when He talks in that verse 2 and 3, He says, "The mighty man and the warrior and the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan and the skillful enchanter." Okay, what he's talking about here, this is what happened when Jerusalem was finally overrun by its enemies. It actually had three different deportations, two major ones. But in one of the major deportations that they had, where Babylon just came down, overran the city, and then they deported a number of people. Well, one of the first waves to go into captivity were a lot of the craftsmen and a lot of the intelligentsia. As a matter of fact, it was Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that went into that first wave. It was actually, I think, the second wave. The first wave wasn't a major wave as far as the deportation. There was two, you know, critical waves placed about 11 years apart. But in that judgment from God, a lot of these people went off into captivity. And the way that Nebuchadnezzar orchestrated the deportation. He wanted all of the people who were well-educated, especially if they had a skill, like if they were a carpenter, if they were a mason, if they were skilled in any way, shape, or form. He just took them off to Babylon. He was a great administrator because he would just take these people over to Babylon and he'd say, okay, you're going to work for me. So it almost seems like a lot of the cultural elite were the first ones to get it. And you know what the shame of it is? Like in our country, I think so many of our cultural elite, when I talk about the cultural elite, I'm talking about the politicians and the lawyers and the entertainers and, you know, all these people in academia. I'm telling you right now, the majority, the overwhelming majority of these people, these cultural elite in our society, are at war with God. And I'm telling you right now, if they would be the first ones to get it as far as God's judgment is concerned, things might get turned around. I'm serious. But it's usually these people who are in power and position where they have the money. They have, like, for example, look at these politicians. How many of them drive around in limousines? How many of them have bodyguards? How many of them have, you know, they're insulated from so much of the crime and so much of the negative consequences that their decisions are basically causing in this country. Well, in Jerusalem, when the Babylonians came down there, the first wave, or it might have been the second wave, but it was the first major wave to go into captivity, were the cultural elite. And I'm thinking, boy, that it was almost as though that was a mercy from God, too, because they are so responsible for so much what goes on when it comes to our rebellion against God. It just is. And you can see it here. He made this prediction. And then he says this in that verse 4. And I can't help but see this country in it, because that verse 4, I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. Now, that's what I see in this country. Now, what does he mean by that? I'll make mere lads their princes, or basically their politicians. And just apply it today. What does that mean?
People who aren't qualified and
Well, one thing about a child does not have a great deal of wisdom and insight and understanding. A child, he thinks like a child, right? And that's what we have today for leadership in this country as a whole. And I'm not trying to be mean-spirited. I'm not trying to be insulting or anything like that. I'm just saying, look at it. We have leadership today where they cannot make intelligent decisions about anything. They just can't. We can see it. We can see virtually every decision that they make. And I was just teaching a study in a library the other morning, and one of the guys said, you know, I was talking to my wife the other day, and he said that we were watching news, and I said to my wife, if I was going to destroy this country, if I really wanted to destroy this country, I would be making every decision that these politicians are making. And he was so right when he said that, because I could look around and just see what's happening today. It is a judgment from God. It really is. When our politicians cannot agree on anything and the decisions they make are so detrimental to the country. And I'm not trying to pick on anybody. I'm just simply saying they cannot make intelligent decisions. And the reason is because everything is spiritual. Everything is spiritual, but nobody has the good grace to see it, who's running this country. And if you stood up to point things out, if you were to stand up and say, you know what, it says in the Chronicles, God says that if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. Now imagine a politician standing up, or a president standing up and saying that to the Congress. What do you think their response is going to be for him to say such a thing?
Not going to be received very well.
Well, no, it's not. And the media is just going to absolutely crucify him. There's no doubt about it. You see, that's our problem. It's spiritual. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and above all turn from our wicked ways, God will heal our land. But as long as we are in rebellion against God, then we can't solve any of our problems. And he said that latter part of that verse 4, and capricious children will rule over them. What's capricious mean?
Flighty, act on a whim.
Good, exactly. They just act on a whim. They're unpredictable. They're flighty. They're erratic. They're always changing their opinion or what they do. I mean, we see this. We see this very clearly. Most of our politicians, what do? They lick their finger and they stick it up in the air to see which way the wind is blowing. They will just flip-flop back and forth over and over again to try to placate the voters rather than doing what that needs to be done. It's like their children, capricious children, will rule over them. Totally unpredictable. And the reason is they have no core values. You see, if we had people that are running this country that had some core values and just said, you know what, this is the right thing to do, and I don't care if I don't get reelected, I'm going to do the right thing before God and for this country. Yeah, you see, now, this is a person with core values. But how many people with core values are in leadership today? And verse 5 it says, and people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor, and the youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. Look at that. Is that our country today? I mean, to me, I just see it very clearly, that people will be oppressed. I mean, look at how we are being oppressed in so many different ways. I don't care whether it's economically, and I don't care whether it's socially. I don't care. More and more, the criminals are taking over. I mean, they just are. I mean, if you don't think we're oppressed, try walking down the street late at night in a major city. You'll see what I'm talking about. The people are scared for their life. And then he says here, each one by another, each one by his neighbor, in terms of being oppressed, but it says the youth will storm against the elder. Do you know, back in Leviticus, God, there was a law in the book where God said, listen, if an elderly man, a hoary-haired man or a gray-haired man, were to walk by some youths that were just sitting down, chewing the fat, smoking cigarettes, whatever they did back then, if an older man was to walk by, do you know what God said they had to do?
Stand up.
You had to stand up in respect for your elders. Now, can you imagine that today? You don't see that, right? There is no respect for the elders. And you see this total breakdown. You know why? Everything's just being uncivil. People are just uncivil today. And they have a total lack of thoughtfulness and consideration for anybody else. I mean, that's what we're just seeing. And that's a judgment from God, right? It says right here, the youth will storm against the elder and the inferior against the honorable. I mean, how many times do we see this in a situation where you have... it's almost becoming epidemic. I just saw it on the news tonight. Another person trying to outrun the cops, all right? And you know when that happens, it's just going to end up in disaster. You know what I'm saying? How many times do we see that on the news? Somebody trying to outrun the police, or somebody really being rebellious against the authorities over him, or just flat out, you know, start shooting it out with the police. Well, you look at this; it says the inferior against the honorable. I mean, there's virtually no respect for authority, right? It's a total breakdown. And he says in verse 6, it says, when a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, "You have a cloak; you shall be our ruler." And these ruins will be under your charge. He will protest on that day, saying, I will not be your healer, for in my house there is neither bread nor cloak. You should not appoint me ruler over the people. Now, what is he saying here in that verse 6 and 7? What he's saying here is that things are going to get so bad, they won't even find somebody that wants to be the leader, because they can see that the problems are absolutely unsolvable. And they're innumerable. Read it again. Verse 6. When a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you shall be our ruler. And these ruins will be under your charge. Look at that. In other words, this whole mess, we'll give it to you. We'll make you our leader. You figure out how to fix this. Right? And it's everybody can see these problems are unsolvable. Right? That's why he says these ruins will be under your charge. But he will protest on that day, saying, I will not be your healer, for in my house there is neither bread nor cloak, and you should not appoint me to be ruler of your people. I mean, that's how bad things are going to get in terms of nobody even wants to try, because they can see that these problems cannot be solved. And I see this in this nation. I really do see it in this country. And like I said, everything's spiritual, but who has the good grace to see it? That the reason we have so many problems is because we have forsaken God. That's it. We've forsaken God, and that's why we cannot solve our problems. In verse 8, he says, for Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. God was down there. He had his temple down there in Jerusalem and Judah. But look what it says here. She stumbled. She's fallen. Why? It says here, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord. Now, if you stood up and said, as a politician or just anybody who's, you could even be an entertainer and stand up and say, you know what, we have really forsaken God. That's why we have so many problems. What's going to be the response? They're going to be in your face thinking, well, you know, we haven't forsaken God. But anybody with any common sense can say, you know what, everywhere we've turned, we have kicked God out of our country. In other words, we've kicked him out of our classroom. We've kicked him out of our courts and out of our judicial system. We've kicked him out of our places of employment. We've kicked him out of even some places, even in our churches or our homes. And so that's why he says, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord. That's us. It's like they always hide behind this separation of church and state, and that's their speech. But it's always against God. But they never come out and say, hey, we're at war with God. No. But their speech does what? It betrays them because everything they do is against God. This is what he's talking about here when he says, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. They do not want God around. Is that right? Is that what we've gotten? Here's the irony. These are religious people. And so are people in this country. When I say religious, I mean people you could stick a microphone in everybody's face in this country and you will find out that over 90% of the people in this country claim to believe in God. But when it talks about his presence, to rebel against his glorious presence means we don't want him around. We just want him up there as a cuddly mascot, as some senile, benevolent old granddaddy, as some kind of butler or Santa Claus to just simply make us feel comfortable in our sins. But we do not want him around. And when it says here to rebel against his glorious presence means, hey, listen, we'll throw him a bone when we feel like it, as long as he stays in his place and doesn't put any demands on us. That's what we've gotten, and that's where these people were going to get. In verse 9, it says, the expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Now, what is he saying here? Think hard, think deep. And it applies to today so well. Look at verse 9. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Well, I mean, it's talking about here homosexuality. It's going to be rampant. Well, he was predicting that because of Judah, that would be very, very prevalent then. But that's very, very prevalent today. What it says here, the expression of their faces bears witness against them. In other words, this lifestyle has not just tolerated and accepted, it's promoted. And you can see it in the determination on people's faces that this is going to prevail. Gay marriage, the homosexual agenda. If you ever witness, let's say, a gay pride parade, this is what you see on their faces. And I will say this 1,000 times. Listen, I don't have anything against any homosexual. I don't even care if you're homosexual. I don't care what you do to who. I just don't. It doesn't matter to me. But here's the thing. This is what God has said. He's the final authority. There is no appeal above him. He's the final authority on this behavior. And so all I'm saying is, hey, this is what God has said. It's certainly not what I would tell you, but I'm not going to change what he has said. Don't shoot the messenger because you don't like the message, because I'm telling you, it's not my message. This is God's message. But people always like to somehow vilify anyone who basically even mildly objects to this kind of behavior. Now, read this again, because this is us. I mean, it says here, the expression on our faces bears witness against them, and they displayed their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. But what does God say? Woe to them. What does woe mean?
Watch out.
Man, it means a disaster. It means calamity. It means destruction. It means judgment. And it says, woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. In verse 10, it says, say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. Woe to the wicked, it will go badly with him, for what he deserves will be done to him. Now, in other words, what God is saying here is that regardless of how bad things may get, is that God still makes a distinction between the righteous and the wicked. That's what it's saying here. It really does. And people think, well, God doesn't care, or he's indifferent. Or he's unconcerned. But no, he's telling us very clearly that regardless of how bad things get morally, that he's still going to make a distinction between those who serve him, those who obey him, those who fear him, and those who don't. And that's what it's saying. And then verse 12, O my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. O my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your path. Now that's us today. It's just epitomize where we are at as a nation. It really does. He says, oh, my people. Now, you tell me, does this country claim to belong to God? Does this country lay claim to being God's people? In spite of everything, we still do. And what did Solomon say? God tells us that if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I'll heal their land. So he says, oh, my people, their oppressors are children. Their oppressors are those people who are over them are children. He's repeating himself for emphasis. In other words, they cannot make common sense, intelligent decisions, right? And he says, and women rule over them. Now, what does that mean? I know the Now gang would take offense at this, but what does that mean? I don't care what the feminists say. Let's just call an ace a spade. God has primarily designed men for leadership. And I'm not saying that women can't lead. I'm just simply saying that what makes, well, there's a multitude of reasons, but one of the things that make a man a better leader is because when really difficult decisions need to be made, he's more inclined to make the decision that needs to be made from basically a logical perspective. What is a woman's decision going to be based more on normally?
Emotions.
Emotions. All right? Emotions. That's just the way God has made male and female.
Generally speaking.
Generally speaking. I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to be a male chauvinist pig here. And neither is God. It's just looking at this situation and saying, you know what? When it says women will rule over them, here's the suggestion in that, is that we're being ruled by politicians who make decisions based on emotion and feeling rather than, hey, this is the right thing to do and we're going to do it. Even though it's going to be very costly or very difficult, we're going to do the right thing. Even though some people are going to be offended, you know, we can't be all things to all people. We need to do the right thing. And that's what he's saying. And women will rule over them. Oh, my people, those who guide you, lead you astray, and confuse the direction of your path. I mean, it's not just politicians. A lot of times you see this even within the church, those who guide you, even the spiritual leaders. And like I said, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but there are a growing number of people within the church. I don't care whether they're pastors or ministers or priests that lead you astray. What is supposed to be the direction for our path? In other words, let me back up. Back in Psalm, I think, 119, it says, thy word is a lamp unto my feet. When you do away with God's word, then what happens? You just confuse the direction. And verse 13, it says, the Lord arises to contend and stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor, declares the Lord God of hosts. And he's talking to leadership here. It doesn't matter what leadership, whether it's political or religious. But you know, Jesus dealt with this. He dealt with this time and again in his own generation. And he dealt with the rulers. Remember, I don't know, when we went through Luke, we just finished that book up not too long ago. But in the 20th chapter of Luke, Jesus was dealing with the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he said to them, beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and have long respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. And then you're reading over here where it talks about you have devoured the vineyard, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. You know, these people would do this, quote unquote, legally. During Jesus' day, what they would do is, if a woman lost her husband, well, she's lost her sole provider. And so a lot of times she would have to take a loan out from these leaders or from these wealthy people. And a lot of them were religious. And they'd say, okay, we'll loan you some money here to get you through until your crops come in or whatever. But then they were just loan sharks. They would charge them at just exorbitant interest rates. And they would deliberately do this because then the people wouldn't be able to come up with the payment. And they say, okay, now your house is mine. Now your vineyard is mine. Now your orchard is mine. Now your property is mine. And God is just absolutely hates that, taking advantage of these poor people like that. And nothing's changed because this was 700 years before Christ. And Christ came along and they were still doing it. And it's nothing's changed. People are still doing it today. But it's abhorrent to God. And then he says in verse 16, he says, moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tingle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads heads bear. And that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal clothes, robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. Now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of a well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth, and branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword, and your mighty ones in battle. Her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted, she will sit on the ground. Now, let's just read this chapter 4. Because it ties right into it, dovetails right into it. I wish they didn't make the break there. But read this chapter 4, beginning with verse 1, because it goes right in hand in glove with what we're reading up top. It says, "For seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, 'We will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes, only let us be called by your name, take away our reproach.'" And okay, now, that's what I wanted to read before we go any further, is to tie it in. What God is saying to these women, and look at, let's just say in our own country today, look at the tremendous emphasis that's being put upon physical beauty. And there's nothing wrong with physical beauty. I think it's commendable. I really do. But this is what Peter said, and matter of fact, Paul said basically the same thing. But 1 Peter chapter 3, he says this, "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelries or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God." Now, here's the thing. I know that there are some churches that are very, very legalistic, and they will take something that, like what Peter just said here, and they will say, well, see, women can't wear makeup and they can't wear jewelry because that makes them nothing but Jezebels or whatever. And that's not what he's saying here. Because if you read the context, he's saying, don't let your adornment be external only, as far as braiding of the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses. So if you forbid wearing jewelry, then you'd have to forbid wearing dresses. I mean, you got to be mature in what you're thinking here. So there's nothing wrong with a woman enhancing her beauty. I would encourage it. I really would. And I think the Bible encourages it. And I think it can be glorifying to God. But here's the thing. When it becomes an obsession, when our looks become an obsession, your body becomes your God, your idol. And Paul tells us pretty much the same thing in 1 Timothy chapter 2. He said this. He said, "Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair or gold pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as proper for women making a claim to godliness." Now, that's what he says, and he says it pretty much like Peter's said. But then you go back over here, and why are these women being basically chastised by God as far as where they're coming from? Look at that verse 16. "Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion..." Now, the daughters of Zion would be who?
Women of Israel.
Yeah. Zion could be interchangeable with Jerusalem. So it's basically God's people in Jerusalem. "The daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and with seductive eyes." There's the key. Seductive eyes. It appears that so much of their physical braiding of the hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and all of their mincing around, it was meant to seduce. And I think we could see that pretty well today. That's just a foregone conclusion when you look around at our values today. And like I said, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with wearing jewelry or having ornaments or any such thing, but their whole purpose for dressing was to dress seductively. And that's when a woman dresses seductively, well, it's a real weakness for a man, and a man just has a real struggle with lust. And that's what's going to happen to these women who entice men to adulterize even in their own heart. I mean, what does he say he's going to do to them? Look at that verse 24. "Now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, it will be putrefaction." In other words, when their cities are overrun by the Babylonians, this is what's going to happen to them. you know, it will come about instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Now understand something. We can make this application to what's going to happen in this country and around the world. Because before Christ returns, this whole planet is going to be a total, complete disaster. Ecological disaster. Through war, through nuclear destruction, through all kinds of famine and disease. This is what's going to end up happening. Because it says here, now will come about, instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. A rope for what? These women are going to be led off into exile as slaves. So instead of a belt around their waist, they're going to have a rope, and that rope is going to tie them to another person in front of them and another person in front of them, and they're going to be tied together with the rope as they're led off into slavery, into captivity. And he says, instead of a well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Now, how would you have a plucked-out scalp? When the Babylonians overrun Jerusalem, they're going to grab women by the hair and pull them along, you know, to chain them up with ropes. So you can see here how God is judging them. And it says, instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth, meaning that they're going to be dressed in mourning because of what's coming upon them. And branding instead of beauty. What would branding suggest?
Ownership.
Yeah, they're going to become slaves, right? And in verse 25, your men will fall by the sword and your mighty ones in the battle. In other words, this is all going to be the result of war. But then, let's face it, when there's war, what gender usually gets wiped out? It's usually always the men. So what does that produce? A kind of shortage when it comes to men. So because of war, look what's going to happen now. And her gates will lament and mourn. In other words, her gates is where they made all the decisions in terms of judgments. So it's talking about here that their judicial system is going to be finished and through.
Oh, it sounds a lot like the Nazis.
Right. Her gates will be lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. Like you said, that's what happened to a lot of the Jews when the Nazis took over, right? But what Isaiah is talking about primarily was when the Babylonians came down. Does anybody have anyone to add to that chapter 3 of Isaiah? Okay, chapter 4 of Isaiah. That verse 1, I wanted to tie it in with verse 26 of chapter 3 because it says 4, or basically because he says 7 women will take hold of one man in that day. We will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach. So what are they saying? What's their reproach?
Their barrenness, their singleness.
Yeah. They just feel like, man, being an old maid, man, that's a real disgrace, right? So 7 women would get hold of one man and say, hey, man, we'll provide for ourselves. Just give us our name so we don't have this reproach against us. See, because of the scarcity of men, because of this judgment, right? Now, look what he's saying here in verse 2. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. It will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, and everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy. There will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and a refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. Now, amazing what Isaiah is doing right here. What is he predicting? What is he talking about in that verses 2 through 6? Now, first of all, what's the branch?
Jesus Christ.
It's Jesus Christ. I mean, we hear that in Jeremiah, we see that in Isaiah, and we see that, like, for example, in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 8, he says, now listen, Joshua. Now, Joshua was a high priest during Zechariah's day. He says, now listen, Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who are sitting in front of you, indeed, they are men who are a symbol, for behold, I am going to bring in my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have set before you, Joshua, on a stone are 7 eyes. Now, he's talking about the branch here. The branch is Jesus Christ. And Jeremiah refers to Jesus Christ as being the branch. And he's referred to as the root of Jesse. And we are told that he would be like a tender shoot coming up from the ground. He's the branch that he's talking about here. So he's talking about Christ's second coming and setting up his millennial kingdom. These people are going to go through all these judgments. They already have for centuries. They've been through these judgments. But it's almost like everything they've gone through so far, it's almost tame in comparison of what they're going to go through, especially the last 3.5 years of the world, the last three and a half years of the tribulation period. But when Christ comes back and he sets up his kingdom, the Jews who look to him when he comes back with great power, great glory, we are told in Zechariah that they will look upon him whom they have pierced, and they will turn their lives over to him. But it says here in that verse 2, in that day, that phrase, in that day, is talking about the end times, end of the world, or the second coming of Christ. He says, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. That's when Jesus Christ comes back and he sets up his millennial kingdom. All right, and it talks about how things are going to be so turned around in terms of the world conditions. If you can, jump over to chapter 11. All right. I just want to read this because this is what he's talking about. If you look in Isaiah chapter 11, it says, then a shoot will spring up from the stem of Jesse. Now he's talking about a branch here, right? Then a shoot. This shoot is Jesus Christ. The stem of Jesse. Who's Jesse?
David's father.
So Jesus Christ is going to be the son of David. So he says this, then a shoot will spring up from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from its roots will bear fruit. That's the same branch I read about in Zechariah. It's the same branch he's talking about here in chapter 4. He says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. The spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and strength, the spirit of knowledge and the spirit in the fear of the Lord. You know, that's the seven spirits of God. I've mentioned that many, many times. The spirit of the Lord is the Holy Spirit. And then you got this, the spirit of wisdom and understanding and counsel and strength and knowledge and the fear of the Lord. These were all on Christ. And he says here, verse 3, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. That's when he returns, right? And it says here in verse 5, also righteousness will be a belt around his loins, and his faithfulness the belt about his waist. Now listen to this. This is what's going to happen when he returns. It says here, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze, their young will lie down together, the lion will eat straw like an ox, the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, nations will resort to the root of Jesse and will stand as a signal for the peoples, and its resting place will be glorious. And it also, he goes on to say in other places, that they will beat their swords into plowshares and into pruning hooks. That's when Christ was going to return. And he tells us in Isaiah 65, when we get to there, he says the same thing, that the wolf will lie down with the lamb. I mean, these are natural enemies, right? And he said, the lion will eat straw like an ox. In other words, they're not going to be any more carnivorous animals feeding on each other. It's going to be like before the fall. And he says, a little child can play in a den full of rattlesnakes and not be harmed. I mean, that's when Christ is going to be ruling and reigning. So when it says here, that verse 2 of chapter 4 of Isaiah, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be a pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. The survivors are the ones who are left after God's judgments, right? And verse 3, and it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. And when we get into chapter 13 in this book of Isaiah, it talks about the end of the world. It talks about the destruction of the world. And God said this very plainly. He says in chapter 13 of Isaiah, thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for the iniquity, and I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. Now listen to what he says. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than gold of Ophir. So this world is on the very threshold of tremendous upheavals and destruction. I watched that documentary by Ben Stein titled Intelligent Design or ID. And In that movie, in that documentary, it said that there's 8 billion people in the world today. I didn't know we were up that high, but we are told that at the very beginning of all this destruction, that a quarter of mankind is going to be wiped out. So that's 2 billion people right there. But by the time the 7-year tribulation is over, we are told right here, I just read it here in Isaiah chapter 13, that God's going to make men scarcer than gold, scarcer than pure gold of Ophir, that he's going to eliminate the sinners from this world. Now, everybody's a sinner, but what he's saying is, every unrepentant sinner is going to be eliminated from this world. And he's going to set up his millennial kingdom, and then he's going to rule there in Jerusalem. And he's going to rule and reign for 1,000 years. And that's when the Jews, the remaining Jews, are going to commit their life to him, and they're never going to be unfaithful again. You see what Isaiah is doing? He's making short-term prophecies about what's going to happen to Jerusalem in about 100 years from when he's prophesying this. But then he reaches thousands of years into the future as far as Christ's reign, his reign. And I just read it there in Isaiah chapter 11. He says in that verse 4, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed from Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. And the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and even smoke and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy. There will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and a refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. Now, where do we read about that? When did that happen?
In the wilderness.
Yeah, in the wilderness, God led his people by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And believe it or not, when Christ sets up his millennial kingdom and he's ruling and reigning in Jerusalem, there's going to be a physical presence that people can see probably from miles and miles and miles away. And that presence is going to be this. Read that verse 5 again. Then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion, that's Jerusalem, and over her assemblies, a cloud by day. You're going to be able to see this cloud from miles away. But this cloud signifies the presence of God. And even smoke and a brightness of a flame by fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy. In other words, they're going to see this presence of God there, over where Christ is ruling and reigning. I guess the palace or wherever he's living in there, or the temple probably, that he will be living in at that time. There will be a manifestation over this temple of fire by night and, you know, a pillar of cloud by day. That will show his physical presence there when he's ruling and when he's reigning. And it goes all the way back to God's presence back there in the wilderness where we read in Exodus how God had led them. Anybody have anyone to add or share? He's quite an amazing prophet, isn't he? I mean, the predictions that he's made and the ones that have already been fulfilled and the ones that we can see are, you know, we're just at the threshold of having fulfilled